Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, your host. Thank you once again for joining us. Today we have Olivia Goldhill joining us. Have you guys checked out Quartz? Quartz is a news site, and it's one of the few ones that I subscribe to. If you haven't checked it out, it's a really, really, really cool daily email giving you a lot of different interesting, insightful, actually really well-rounded news site. It's not just your average story. And from there, I discovered Olivia Goldhill. She reached out to me to come onto the show, and she writes about authenticity. So I was like, we got to do it. She's a philosophy, a Harvard educated philosophy student, and is interested in several subjects, but one of them is authenticity. Thought, have her on the show. She writes about it. She thinks about it. We did more of a deep dive into it from the philosophy of existentialism and what it means. Hope you like today's show. Check it out. You can find out more about Olivia at Quartz, and that is Quartz. Check it out. Again, I love it. I think you'll love it too. Thank you again for tuning in. Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, and today we have Olivia Goldhill joining us. Hey, Olivia, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining in. I'm excited to chat with you. Olivia and I were just chatting before the show. She is a Harvard-trained philosophy major and now writes at Quartz, where she has written a few articles on authenticity. So we thought we're going to be a little indulgent. Today is a little bit of a philosophy lover's discussion. So hopefully this conversation will stir the imagination about authenticity, what it really means. What did the philosophers really talk about when, you know, they started discussing these topics? And to the best of our ability, not that we're experts by any stretch, we'll try to help unpack some of these incredible ideas. So first of all, just give the audience a moment here. You write for Quartz. How long have you been? First of all, if you guys don't know Quartz, you got to check it out. It's amazing. It's one of the few news emails that I get every day. What brought you to Quartz? Tell everybody about Quartz just a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, our emails are very popular, as are our articles and website. So I've been with Quartz since September 2015, so kind of a year and a half now. I was a features writer before, and I would kind of occasionally dabble in philosophy just because I love it, so I'd mention it. And when I came to Quartz, I said I think it could work really well to make philosophy my focus. And Quartz, we're very international, have an audience of roughly 20 million a month. And it started as very much a business economic site, but quirky and intelligent. And we're kind of the guide to the new global economy, this kind of crazy changing world. And
yeah, the articles are just amazing. I mean, it's the combination of you getting the daily news and what's going on and just great writers, but then they bring up, you know, ideas of happiness or, you know, just like the most random stuff too. So it's really fun and different.
Yeah, it's quite quirky. And so the editor-in-chief really liked this idea of, you know, philosophy is a way of explaining this incredibly turbulent time as well. And so it's, I personally write on philosophy and psychology and a bit of ethics, and I write about old ideas that are relevant today or advances in the sciences and big philosophical questions.
Yeah, no, if you guys haven't checked it out, definitely check out Quartz and sign up. It's just really good. But today, what, you know, you've written on authenticity, you've written on the questions of authenticity in modern day life. And one of the things we're chatting about before the show that I just said, let's pause and make sure this gets on, is currently there's this big trend in meditation, which is fantastic. Stoicism has taken a huge turn towards popularity. I had Ryan Holiday on here, who wrote a lot of about Stoicism, and he's been one of the people who has made it very popular. But when people are turning towards Stoicism and meditation, do you feel like they're capturing the essence of what these philosophies are really about and what they mean for our life? Or is it really, in your mind, for serving another purpose?
Well, I think it varies a lot. One trend that I've noticed and I'm personally wary of is when these philosophies are used as a means to be more productive. So I've seen kind of adverts on the subway and where meditation and meditation apps are billed as a way of doing more. You know, once you meditate, you'll be more effective at work. And that's really not the goal. And you can't, I mean, I only dabble in meditation. I'm by no means an expert, but you really won't achieve what you should be if your focus the whole time is going to be applying the lessons from meditation into getting your next big deal. And so I think that's a danger. And stoicism, I mean, so Ryan Holiday does a great job, and I know plenty of philosophers who think that he captures the ideas very well, but it can be used, if you're not kind of reading it fully and looking at all the ideas, it can be used almost as a life hack. And sometimes Ryan Holiday does present it as a life hack. And that's okay to some extent in isolation. I mean, the Stoics did say that, you know, they did have rules and ways of thinking that would help you, I mean, be more rational and to be less kind of affected by your emotions and by circumstances outside your control. But there's a lot more there than just these life hacks. But it's interesting because when you were talking about this, I did an interview recently with this philosophy professor, and she's also a yoga instructor. And that was really interesting. And they're kind of two sides of her world. And she decided to teach a course on the philosophy behind yoga. And that's something that can be seen in a way as a bit confused in the West. I mean, we don't have a long history of yoga, and what are we doing? We're co-opting these ideas. And so it was fascinating to hear what she said. And she said these two traditions, philosophical traditions behind yoga, and they always have contradictory ideas. One of them is the idea that there's kind of only one pure essence, and you should be kind of overcoming your body and your material possessions and even your relationships to focus on this kind of one essence in the universe. And the other is the idea that no, there's a lot of meaning in other aspects of life and in your body, at least, and in kind of non-abstract ideas.
Yeah.
And you sometimes see that in yoga classes. You'll see some yoga classes are all about it being kind of very hot and overcoming your body and not listening to your pain, and others are much more kind of sensitive. But her point was, there's always been kind of mixed messages here, and it's not so terrible to take them and do something else and adapt it slightly. But I think it's important just to consider what those broader philosophies are and how they're being adapted.
Yeah, and what I hear in your explanation is you know, something I have not thought about, but just to pay note, is this being used? Of course, if you meditate, the secondary benefit will be that you're calmer, at ease, letting go of thoughts that aren't helpful, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that can, of course, help you get more done if you're really thinking about it. But if the goal up front is I'm going to meditate for 5 minutes so that I can, right? Like, I don't think you're going to get there. Like, I worry that if that's already the agenda and on your mind, it won't allow you to let go and enjoy the benefits of the meditation. Or if you're like flipping through Stoicism looking for the hack, it might defeat the philosophy that they, you know, you might miss the nuances and maybe the depth of maybe what they're talking about. And so, yeah, I love that. And I love how you put it, that there's a balance there. It's not that you can't find the practical value. It's just that looking for only the practical in these things can really lead to a misunderstanding or misrepresentation of what the value of them is. Is that fair?
Right. Yeah. And I also think a lot of these ideas, the reason why they're so powerful and important is they make you question some of your existing habits and behaviors. And so if you're only, you know, for example, using meditation to get better at your to-do list, you know, maybe your to-do list isn't that important. And, you know, uh-huh, maybe if you were kind of really focused on kind of the values and ideas and meditating, uh-huh, kind of becoming more at peace with yourself or contemplating yourself and your decisions more, you might decide, well, some aspects of this to-do list aren't that valuable to me and I do something else. So,
right. So it has a practical value, but just don't put meditation on the to-do list. as don't yeah. like just watching how far you go with the whole concept. I love that idea. And, you know, just never really, people say to me, oh, well, yeah, I really want to meditate. I should get that done, right? Like, it's like one more thing to add to a list. And it can help you in your life. But I think it defeats sort of this broader purpose of slowing down and allowing yourself to maybe see things differently and to view your life differently, which is really what philosophy in the end is about. It's perspective and questioning reality and questioning your place in reality. And that's why I love it so much, because I think that process, that set of questions on a regular basis can lead towards a better life and a better experience if you know, do it regularly and use these philosophical ideas to help guide you. So I ask people who come on the show, and I wanted to focus our conversation down to this question that I usually ask at the end, but what an authentic life really means. Because the other thing we were chatting about was the complexity of the topic, and why I have chosen to do a podcast and make my whole world around this topic is because I don't know that there's a singular answer. So what does an authentic life mean to you? What have you, from the philosophy you studied at Harvard to writing about it at Quartz, what do you make of that concept?
Right. And I have to say also, I don't know if I have a singular answer, but I remember I was once suggesting an article on authenticity to my editor, and she was kind of very suspicious of the topic. And she said, I mean, I don't know if I like authenticity. So many people use authenticity as an excuse to be horrible. And I think that, like, a lot of people have a similar opinion. They're a bit mistrustful of authenticity. And it really, when she said that, instinctively seemed to me that can't be true authenticity. That can't be, you know, what we mean when we're using that word. Otherwise, it's completely valueless.
So back up for just a second to the listeners who, when you say your editor had that response, what is it that she has in mind? Why is she, what do you think the backlash against that word is exactly?
I think from her perspective, she was thinking of, you know, when someone is rude or impolite and says, well, I'm just being authentic. I can't hide it. This is who I am. And it's being abrasive, and it's being difficult. I mean, I started thinking of, and I think this was an article I did on kind of how do you know when you're being authentic. I was getting suspicious of these claims of authenticity that you see a lot in advertising, or you see on Instagram, kind of even hashtag no filter. That posturing at authenticity, that seemed to me very insincere.
And how ironic that it's insincere to be literally posting about being sincere, right?
Right. But I think there is that. And I think, that's why I think this podcast is valuable, because you can't just say you want to be authentic. You have to consider what it really means. And so, I mean, if from a psychological perspective, there's, you know, I think Maslow has a very interesting theory, the idea of self-actualization, and that once you have certain needs met, so kind of physiological, safety, social esteem, then you can become self-actualized and authentic, and a person who is authentic would be open to new experiences, and they wouldn't be hostile. And he kind of has a clear notion of what an authentic person looks like, and it's a very positive person.
And if you haven't seen Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you can Google it. It's this cool little triangle, and at the top is self-actualization. But his belief system is very strongly based in meeting our needs for it. It's a privilege. Yeah. Do you see it that way? That it's sort of after I've met all my basic needs and I can then think about self-actualization.
I think it's something that we are all striving for. And I think that's what, as I thought, and it's funny because he presents it as a pyramid, but when I was looking at it in the psychologist who spoke to, he said, you can miss a step. You don't have to do the bottom layer first and then work up. You're just kind of pulling all the strands together. But yeah, unless, I guess part of the idea is quite almost indulgent. It's the idea that if you don't look after yourself, you can't be authentic in this way. If you don't have these, like, really, but he's not selfish, because, you know, it's not just about looking after your own needs. You know, if you're not going to be kind of considerate to others, then you're simply, you won't be self-actualized and you won't be authentic.
So this is why I love this topic, because, you know, if you start talking about it, it starts becoming what it's not, because it's so hard to verbalize what it is. And so, right, it's not selfish. It's not self-indulgent. It's taking care of one's needs, but not in that sort of excessive way. It's not claiming to be authentic and being rude and outside of culture isn't it. It's speaking truth, but not truth to be harmful, right? And it's like, it's this funny space where it's sort of between a bunch of things and it's hard to put exact language around.
Right. And it's actually, because I've got another thing that it is not, but, you know, Maslow's theory comes to mind, because he presents this image of, or not an image, but a description of a really kind of well-rounded, satisfied person and a very kind person. But I think that doesn't mean that you're kind of always going to be excessively kind of positive or friendly. I mean, this is a separate idea, but I recently wrote an article which was, I was drawing on sociology, but also personal, because I kind of had an injury. And then in the aftermath of this kind of quite traumatic injury, I found it very difficult in public that there was this insistence on positivity, kind of from people I didn't know, you know, like in coffee shops or in, you know, Ubers. And I was not positive at that time, and for good reason. I'd had a very traumatic experience, and I think that's valid. You know, you're allowed to be sad and you're allowed to be unhappy. And that doesn't mean kind of you're going to make other people sad, but it also means you don't have to hide it and you don't have to kind of present this falsely positive image to others as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So authenticity is not false happiness and just being positive, you know, and all this Instagram quoting, and that you're not just one walking quote of gratitude, that there's difficulties in life, right? And you can be authentically having a hard day and authentically like having a hard year. That, so it's not that either. And I do think people very much misconstrue from my reading on authentic living the pleasure, the happiness that we gain out of hedonistic pleasures, or just slapping a smile on it and being happy with being authentic, right? You can, I coach clients and we get to this point all the time and they say, wait a minute, I'm having a really bad day and that's okay too. And I'm like, yeah, like being authentic means it's all okay on some level, right? Like, but not those social constraints. I mean, you can't just walk up to people and tell them terrible things without a consequence. It doesn't mean that there's not consequence for behavior. It just means that whatever you're experiencing, if it's truly a manifest of your truth, then dealing with that is the right move. So we were then talking about, well, what does that mean? This truth, this deeper self, this essence. And one thing you brought up was Sartre. You've written to Sartre and you've thought about the existentialists and what they've thought about our essence and truth. What is your view on that essence and truth? Because that's another very complicated topic that I feel that, you know, philosophy doesn't necessarily agree on and people don't agree on.
Definitely. Huge variety of opinions. And so I personally really like the existentialist view and it just naturally appeals to me. I mean, Sartre, he kind of sets it out most clearly, which is where I end up talking about him, even though he's not necessarily my favorite existentialist. But his idea and the existentialist idea is that existence precedes essence. So for many other things, essence would precede existence. So if you were, the classic example is a carpenter creating a chair, you would have kind of the essence of the chair, the idea of the chair in your mind, and then you would build it accordingly to kind of match that idea. And for humans and for each individual, that is not the case at all. So it's not that you have one true inner essence and then you're acting to reflect that. It's that your behavior and your existence comes first, and that's what creates whatever essence you have. So the famous example that Sartre spoke about, he had a student and the student kind of was at a crossroads in his life. He didn't know whether he should go and fight in the resistance and perform that kind of duty, or if he should stay and help his mother who was ill. And he didn't know what to do. He didn't know which was the of greater moral value. He didn't know who he was. And Sartre's answer was, well, there's no right answer here, and there's no kind of inherently true answer that would reflect who you really are. It's whatever you decide. Whatever you decide will be whoever you in fact are. And it's the act of deciding that makes you that person. If you decide to stay at home and look after your mother, that then shapes you and means that you are the kind of person who stays at home to look after your mother. And So it's this idea that we're doing that all the time, that kind of everything we do is creating ourselves. And we ultimately, we have total responsibility for that, which is another big idea in existentialism. You are responsible for everything, really, for who you are and all your actions and the consequences. And that should be scary. That should kind of provoke anxiety. And I think so the existentialists just, they don't kind of explicitly write about kind of being authentic, but they do write about bad faith, which is, I guess, like being inauthentic. And if you're acting in bad faith, then you often haven't fully considered the responsibility of your actions and the weight of them, and you haven't grappled with that anxiety and that meaning.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because I love the concept of responsibility for actions. It's something I've talked about a lot, and I think we are so responsible, but it's so easy to fall prey to the idea that you're a victim to your own actions, which is so perplexing to me. But so many of us, I've done it, and so many people do it at some point in their life. They blame other people or situations, and then they're, you know, victims to their own behaviors, their own actions. And I think that's where we really fall off the wagon in life, if we don't take full, complete responsibility for our actions. And this question of like what comes first and how that iteration works, right? Like if Sartre's saying, well, if I stay home with my mother, then I am the kind of person that stays home with my mother. But what about when you stay home with your mother and it's inauthentic and the whole time it's just not, it's not working for you? And so somebody has a job, say, and they're listening right now, and that's the action they've taken. They have a job, but like it's never sat right with them. It doesn't feel right. There's a nagging sense that this is not aligned with their deeper self. Sartre, I hear him saying maybe that this is, you have this job and this is now who you are, but you could change jobs, make another decision, and become something else. I always think of it as you're out of alignment with your truer self when you do those things, and that when you get that nagging sense that something's off, or, you know, that frustration that you don't feel life is a mirror back to who you believe you are at a deeper sense, it's because you're out of alignment with that self. How do you think about, like, there's a bit of a chicken and the egg, right? Because right, our experiences do define us and they do create a part of who we are, but right, I've also had a child and there's an essence to him from birth, right? Like, and that part of him has stayed consistent over the years. You know, he's now 11 and there's something just that has feels unmovable about him at the same time. So how do you grapple, how do the philosophers that you love sort of grapple with that concept?
Well, I think they would say, they definitely acknowledge that you can make decisions in bad faith. So, and that would be kind of when you're doing something almost within, well, one way in which you behave in bad faith is when you behave according to a role. So, I mean, the existentialist wrote about kind of like, I think it was Sartre again, he wrote about a waiter in a restaurant kind of performing the act of being a waiter and kind of performing the little hand gestures and the kind of facial expressions that he considered, well, what, you know, it meant to be a waiter. I think we do that the whole time, kind of we make decisions or we behave in a way where we are filling an expected role, we're kind of acting something out. Yeah. And we haven't really considered we haven't fully faced the true range of possibilities or kind of how social expectations are demanding that we behave in a certain way. And we often just go along with that without kind of thinking how we could defy those social expectations or kind of create an alternative option. And that's the idea, I think, of the responsibility. So it wouldn't necessarily be creating an option according to our innermost true self, but it would be the idea that you have the responsibility and the possibility to defy those social expectations, and so not to act according to how everyone else expects of you, and to make the decision yourself. And if you're truly doing that, I think if you're, and it's so difficult to know if you are ever truly doing that, but if you're, you know, truly reckoning with your own responsibility and all the anxiety that comes with that, then you would not be making a decision in bad faith. But if you are, then yeah, you're kind of, you're not, I guess you're almost not fully living and not fully recognizing, you know, the options available to you and the potential and what you could do.
Yeah. So if it's in bad faith, if I'm playing a role, if it's not aligned with, I mean, it's so funny because when you think of the opposite, then if I'm doing it in good faith, that I am doing it through sort of sense of genuine intentions, it does feel like similar to the, you know, Eastern views of authentic self, right? Because it's like, well, what's that good faith? Well, that's just, it feels right within me, I guess, right? Like, how do you know?
And I think there's a certain extent, and I don't know anyone who can say, this is how you know.
Right.
I've asked people, like, how do I know if I'm doing, you know, how do I know if I'm being authentic? How do I know if I'm doing a good faith? And I mean, one thing that someone said to me that's the closest I've got is like, well, how much are you questioning it? If you're questioning whether it's in good faith, if you're like seriously questioning whether you're being authentic, that's kind of the surest kind of early sign as you're going to get. And you can't do it half-heartedly. You can't kind of be like, is this real? Yeah, sure. But if you're grappling with it and kind of really wrestling with like, is this what I should be doing? Then, you know, that's a indication at least that you are trying to do things authentically.
Yeah, no, I love it. I think that's totally fair. And I think that we all know when we're deeply inauthentic, right? Like it feels terrible. And there's a sort of sense of putting on a mask and parading ourselves around and being in a role. And you just can't quite ever touch the ground exactly. And I do think there's a sense when we're in total alignment that we feel happier, grounded, more clear. There's this confidence and but at the same time, you know, making those decisions are not popular. So there can be anxieties because maybe your mother doesn't like it. Maybe like it's risky financially, right? And so that's where all this complexity comes. You know, it's so hard to stay in a sense of truth because there's so many competing realities at the same time of other people's approvals and the financial complexities and whether you'll succeed and the fear of failure, right? Like there's just so much stuff that comes up. And so grappling with it, to your point, having those conversations, asking yourself those questions, right, is part of the work. And if you can at least get yourself there, you've taken yourself a long way down the authentic path.
Right. And it's funny that you mentioned, well, not funny because it makes sense, they go together, anxiety. And that anxiety is something I think about a lot. I mean, I think anxiety is obviously a huge problem. I think it's kind of one of the, I think it's the most common kind of illness today. It affects so many people. But existentialists write about anxiety and they write about how it's important as well. I mean, it's not pleasant. It's not kind of, you're never going to enjoy being anxious, but it is an important experience. And I think it can be valuable. It can kind of make you question, is what I'm doing right? Is what I'm going for right? You know, and not always. Sometimes you just need to turn off the anxiety. But there are cases where it's an emotion that has its place, I think.
Yeah. No, we demonize emotions. They're there to tell us information. Sometimes we're misinformed. And so we have narratives running through our heads that aren't necessarily true, right? Like we feel there's a bear in the bush, but there's not actually a bear in the bush, right? And so you want to differentiate between whether these things are true or not, but the emotion themselves are not the problem, right? But we get so freaked out that we have the emotion and we try to avoid the emotion and stuff down the emotion, right?
Right.
And that becomes its own pain point.
Definitely. And I kind of think, I mean, the way you articulated it is perfect. Sometimes you have an emotion and it's not grounded to anything kind of valid and it's kind of worth kind of, and there actually the Stoics are pretty good at kind of talking about, you know, like talking yourself through the emotions and kind of like to what extent are they kind of corresponding to rational, logical ideas. But yeah, if you're kind of anxious a lot about a particular thing, then maybe it's because it's worth questioning that particular thing.
Absolutely. Well, Olivia, thank you so much for coming on the show, chatting about authenticity, taking us into this deep dive. If people are interested in finding out more about you, checking out Quartz, where can they find your work?
So I'm on Quartz. If you just search my name, Olivia Goldhill Quartz, then you'll find my page, but also if you look at Quartz and everyone else's writing too. On Twitter, I'm at Olivia Goldhill. Those are the two best ways to find me.
Thank you so much for coming on today's show.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Hey, before you go, I have a quick question for you. Have you ever considered coaching? If you have no idea what coaching is, no worries. It's basically like a personalized workout program, but instead of doing 100 squats and a million sit-ups, you're working out your mind, your well-being, and your emotions. Coaching is about setting goals and taking action to create a life that's meaningful to you. As we navigate through life and ask ourselves the tough questions, what do I want? What makes me happy? How do I build a life that works for me? Just like we talk about on the podcast, how do I have success, but have success that's authentic and meaningful? In part, the tactics play a huge role. Setting goals, having priorities that make sense, and making sure you're organized with your lists. After running a company for 15 years, I help my clients with that all the time. But coaching takes it even further. We remove all that stuff, all those mental obstacles that get in your way when you're trying to make those tough life choices. If that sounds interesting to you, come on over to lauraco.com, click on the contact form and send me a note, or at the bottom of the homepage, you'll see a button where you can click and set up a call with me. Just like that, it's free. We'll chat, we'll find out what's going on and see if it makes sense for me to help you out. No strings attached. I hope to hear from you. And again, thank you so much for tuning in. I really value each and every one of you.